Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. On behalf of Torah in Motion, I want to welcome everybody. Jay Kelman, the director of Torah in Motion, I want to welcome you to one of our many classes that we'll be having now in the post-Pesach period, the Sphere period online. We invite you to join, look at our schedule of many, I think, wonderful opportunities to learn with really great people around the world. We hope everybody, most importantly, is healthy and staying well. And we looked at even after we get beyond this, we can still continue much of the learning that we are doing. And it's a pleasure to have Dr. Shapiro, who has, I think, close to 200 online lectures. He's been giving for about 10 years talks online for Torah in Motion on great, great Torah scholars. I strongly encourage people to listen to them if you have not. And it's a pleasure. He said that after Pesach, I'd like to do a couple of classes on the escape of the Mir Yeshiva. I think in a certain way, it's also appropriate. This evening is Yom HaShoah. And we should keep that in mind also. And I want to welcome everybody. And with that, Dr. Mark, please, you can take it away.
Okay, thank you, and I'll mute everyone. Thank you all for being with us. Let me just say, since Rabbi Kelman mentioned, I have about 200 talks on Gedolei and Gedolei Yisrael, that the format of this class today and next week, we said it's the first of a series of two. Truth of the matter is, I don't know. It depends how much we get into it. It could be three. It's not like we have places to be, unfortunately. But for those who haven't yet listened to the classes, this will not be like a lecture format like I had last week when I spoke about Kitnios. It's going to be along the model of looking at the events, going on all sorts of tangents, the sort of thing that at least the people who've been listening for years enjoy, but it'll be different. It'll be more like a free-flowing class than an actual 50-minute lecture. Although it was designed to be a lecture, let me first explain where this comes from before we get into it and why I'm speaking about Shanghai. Well, first of all, the original talk was given in Shanghai, well, not in Shanghai. I was in Shanghai, but then we left and went to a university outside of Shanghai, and that was a year and a half ago. I actually went to China twice in the space of a year, and I know we have online here a number of travelers with us, Torah in Motion travelers, and part of that was I was hoping that maybe we would do a trip to China. I know you think of it now, it's crazy, but believe it or not, the ghetto, which we'll be speaking about in Shanghai, still exists. We don't know how much longer it will exist because they're planning on putting in fancy apartments there. But if you go to Shanghai now, you can be in the place that we will speak about soon enough, where the Jewish community was. And it was an actual ghetto. They were forced to live there, just like in Europe. Then, when we were supposed to all go away to family or wherever for Pesach, I was going to be at a hotel, and I was going to give a talk on the Shanghai, the Mir in the Shanghai. And therefore, I figured since we couldn't do that, I'll share it with the people on Torah in Motion. So I'm happy you're all here. We have a very nice crowd, I see. If there's questions as we go on or comments, you type it in the chat box. About 50 minutes, it's supposed to be an hour, so maybe about 50 minutes or so. There's usually a lot of questions or comments. I'll stop and then I'll answer the comments. If you need to leave or if something comes up, these are all taped, so you can always listen to them later, but it's very nice to have a nice big audience with us. One more thing I want to say about this talk is, or the classes, it is an amazing history, no question about it. In many ways, even speaking from a historical perspective, you know, it's a miraculous thing, some of what we'll see. You don't get the full story, and you won't see the full story in, it's been written up many places, but you won't see it in the typical rabbinic Haredi works for reasons we'll see. We will see that there are mistakes made, not by all the great rabbis, but by some of the great rabbis at various times, and this is not the sort of thing that you will find in the Haredi works, and we'll see plenty of examples, although we will also see that none other than Rabbi Chaskel Levenstein, who's the Mashgiach of the Mir Yeshiva, he takes this on head first, and he looks at it and answers, why was it that everything the Gedol Yisrael said turned out to be wrong? And it is relevant, I think, what's going on now. A number of people have emailed me because we've seen great rabbis in the current situation in the Haredi world in particular, make some unbelievable mistakes, and it raises the issue of the Das Torah, etc. So these are things perhaps we can reflect on. Finally, I'll say that I'm sure some, many of you listening, or at least some of you, were yourselves influenced by the group that went to Shanghai and later would come to America. I know I was, because at JEC, Rabbi Teitz's yeshiva and Elizabeth, Rabbi Shlomovitz, who was a Rebbe I had in 9th and 10th grade, he was one of the people who came with the Mir to Shanghai and into America. And there were many, many others. When they came to America, these people needed jobs and they started teaching at the different yeshivas and the day schools. Some were just regular Rebbes, high school Rebbes and the like. Others were really, Gedol Yisrael, teaching at all sorts of places, from the Haredi yeshivas to the modern Orthodox yeshivas. And in a way, this really revolutionized Torah study, especially in the New York area, because the fact is, until then, you had many people teaching in the day schools who really, I don't know what you call them, maskili maybe, people who in their youth had learned a little Gemara, they came to America, they had to make a parnasa, so they started teaching. And it wasn't the same as when you had the people of, the level of those who went to the Mir. I see, although I will get to the comments at the end, since someone mentioned the Lubavitch Yeshiva, I will also speak about the Lubavitch Yeshiva. I will also be speaking about Chachmei Lublin. As well. But the Mir Yeshiva is the only yeshiva that comes as a unit, the entire yeshiva. So let's get right into it. Well, first of all, what is the Mir Yeshiva? I mean, people, they speak about, when I was in yeshiva myself, they would say there's only two places that begin with the. So you have the Bronx and the Mir. The Mir actually, and there's a space shuttle now. Mir means, whether it means world or village, I think it also can mean peace. And it's a very old yeshiva. We don't exactly know when it began. Approximately, they say 1815. In 2015, they had a big anniversary, but we're not sure. And it goes back right with the Volozhin, right to the beginning, in Mir, which at different times, it's in Belarusia now, it was in Poland, but it's really Jewish-Lithuania. In previous classes, I've shown you this great map. In fact, let me show you right now. Let me... show you where it is so you see right now. And I'll be going back and forth to my map here. You see where I've made blue, red, this is Mir. And look where Vilna is. It's about, I think it's about 150 kilometers. You can check not far from Vilna. That's gonna be very important because we're gonna talk about the border that's there. But notice where Minsk is. Minsk, after World War I becomes part of the Soviet Union, Minsk is only about 90 kilometers away from Mir, which remains part of Poland. So we'll get to this in a little bit. Mir today is the largest yeshiva in the world. We're told that, if you ask people who go there or you look online, I'm told that they say it has 8,500 students in Jerusalem. Forget about Brooklyn. What does that mean, students? How, does it mean they're all registered or something? In any event, it is an enormous yeshiva. And as I said, it's regarded as the largest and apparently also perhaps the oldest, even older than Volozhin might be. The Mir is the only yeshiva to escape with virtually its entire student body during the Holocaust. And it's an incredible story. And it's also an incredible story why the other yeshivas didn't escape. This story of escape comes about because of a fateful decision, which was not taken by the other great institutes of Torah learning. And there were many in Europe. So let me begin with September 19th, 1939, right at the beginning of World War II. The Soviet Union, they split up. Poland was to be split up, and not just Poland, in Eastern Europe. The Soviet Union seizes Vilnius, which was under the control of Poland. Let me show you another map here. Here is what, in the interwar years, it looked like. You see, Poland was quite big, and where Lithuania, right on the right side, right near, right over here, That's where Vilna was. And although Vilna, or as they call it, Vilnius, was the, an important city for them when it was a capital city, when it was not in control of Lithuania, as it wasn't in the interwar years, the capital was in Kovno. We know it as Kovno. They know it as Kaunas. So, and there's back to the city. Okay, so, but the Soviet Union moved in and took Vilna, which was then under the control of Poland. And for its own political reasons, the Soviet Union transfers Vilnius back to Lithuania. So Lithuania could have its most important city. Here again, I'll show you on the map. So this then, what you're looking at, Lithuania, it adds a little more to the, like the right there, and that incorporates now, with Vilna is now incorporated in Lithuania. The important thing is that, take a look at this map. Poland is gobbled up between Russia and Germany. Lithuania remains independent. Lithuania, there was no problems with the communists, no problems with the Nazis, nothing. So that meant that it was a good place to live. In fact, until June of 1940, Lithuania remains independent country. That is, you could leave, you could come, you had Americans going there. It existed, it's a regular place, no different than Switzerland would be or any of the neutral countries. The one difference is that in exchange for giving Vilna back to Lithuania, Lithuania was forced to host, and I put host in quotation marks, military bases for the Soviets and thousands of Soviet troops, obviously enabling them to, whenever they wanted to, just march in. At the same time, much of Jewish Lithuania, which existed in Poland, Belarus, was now inside Polish borders, was occupied by the Soviet Union. So you had large number of Jews inside who were in Poland, but was really what we know as Jewish Lithuania, occupied by the Soviets. Lithuania is free, and Vilna, that is such an important city of Vilna, has now been incorporated into independent Lithuania. Understandably, many Jews began making their way from Soviet-occupied Lithuania, in particular, Soviet-occupied Poland, to Lithuania, in particular Vilna, because it was right on the border. Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski in Vilna, really the leading rabbi in Eastern Europe, you go to Hador, for the Ashkenazim in Eastern Europe, called for all the yeshivas who are now in Soviet-occupied Poland to come to Vilna, because Lithuania is a free place, and they'll be in Vilna, and Torah could go on. And many individuals started to. At first, the border was open, and then when they shut it, it doesn't matter, it was not that difficult to find in those days, all sorts of confusion. Smugglers could take you over. It doesn't seem to be a problem at all getting over. Anyone who wanted to was able to. This is one of these decisions that plenty of people years later look back and said, why didn't I go? Because that was your chance to leave. Soon the borders would be closed and you'd be stuck forever. So Lithuania, Judaism continues. It's a free country with movie theaters and a free press, everything you need. Some 20 yeshivas made their way to Vilna, including the mirror, which comes not just with the students, but with the administration, the families of the people who teach there. And obviously the hope was that not just the mirror, but all these yeshivas would continue in what was still a free country. Just to give you an idea of the yeshivas who came to Vilna, I have a list of them here. Here they are, with the mirror. Mir, they list 273 students that came, but we know there were more. When they left, there was, well, maybe when they actually entered, when they first entered 273, there's going to be close to 350 when they actually leave. Kletsk was there. We have 240 students. Kamenets, Well, Kamenetz, of course, is a great yeshiva, going back to the old Sabotka, which then splits. The Radin yeshiva, some came. And there, Beis Yosef of Bialystok, there's a yeshiva in Pinsk, in Lomja, Baranovich came, Grudna came, and the list goes on. Chochmei Lublin only came with 63 students. There's the Kollel of Mir also, I should have mentioned, 22 families, and a number of other ones. And Brisk even, there was a Yeshivas Brisk that had 27 students they list here. That was already in Vilna. There's an Olbavitch Yeshiva in Vilna, which gives the number of 43 students. This number comes as a very interesting book. Let me show you the picture of it here, in which is useful, but has to be used carefully, as all these works are. You have a three, here you have this book. It's Hebrew volume, Azrichab Fateh Kedem. It's a three-volume history of the Mir Yeshiva. About 1.5 volumes focus on the period in Shanghai. Yeah, it has memoirs, all sorts of interesting stuff. Unfortunately, Bab Mises galore. All sorts of stuff which are not true and can't be true if you know the situation. And maybe I'll mention some of them, but it also is full of original documents. No one can, and pictures as well, no one can do anything about with this, you know, the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai without using that work. And of course, as with all such works, it needs to be used carefully. One person who did not come to Vilna with the Mir was Rav Avraham Tzvi Hirsch Kamai, who was one of the, really one of the Rosh Yeshiva. Even officially, he was considered Rosh Yeshiva. His father was a Rosh Yeshiva. I'll show you his picture. I'll share the screen here with you. And here's a picture of him. There was Eliezer Yehuda Finkel, but he also was the Rosh Yeshiva because he was the son, and you have the son-in-law of Eliyahu Kamai, who was the Rosh Yeshiva before. He was also the Rav of the city of Mir, and he stayed with his community, and he was murdered, as it says, on the 9th of November, 1941. So of all the Mir students, it's all the Mir Yeshiva, he is really the most famous, who never came out. We don't really have much of what he did, what he wrote, because it was all destroyed. In the volume one of the volume I published, the writings of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, I include a lengthy responsum of Rav Avraham Tzvi Hirsch Kamai. It's one of the only responsa of his ever published, which I discovered in an archive. And if you're interested, you can look at it there. He's a Gaon Shebegaonim, great Torah scholar, and unfortunately, just one of many who were murdered in the Holocaust. In terms of the Torah world, the undisputed leader at this time was Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. Those who are interested, I think we did 6 or maybe 8 classes, Torah in Motion, Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, and we could have done a few more. I mean, he wasn't, when you speak about the Gadol B'Yisrael, he wasn't just a Torah authority, he was a leader. I mean, he spent hours each day communicating with important figures in America, in England, political, Jewish political leaders. He was involved. He was head of the fundraising and the distributing of money in to the yeshivas and other people in Vilna. So he was a real Torah leader, not just a Torah scholar. He's one of those people that you wonder how much Torah he was even able to learn, because in the last 10 years of his life, he literally was involved in the community in all sorts of ways. Finding even a few minutes each day to have time for learning would have been very difficult. That's real Torah leaders, not just Torah scholars, but leaders of the community. And Rav Chaim Moser, there's legends. I don't know if they're true about how he could write with two hands, etc. But I mean, constantly people coming to see him, constantly letters coming to him, etc. Now, he would die on August 9th, 1940. But until then, he continues to be at the forefront of everything having to do with the yeshivas. He actually was able to have a Jewish burial, even though the Soviets were in control then. He was not killed. He died, and he was able to have a burial, and that was the last great funeral in Vilna. Before the Soviet occupation, that is from 1939 until until 1940, when they come in mid-1940. When he was asked whether the yeshivas, either as a yeshiva as a whole or individual students, should take advantage of opportunities to leave Lithuania. I mean, there weren't many opportunities, but some people were able to get. You can get visas to America, to Canada, to Palestine. His answer was, when it came to the Eretz Yisrael, okay, if you can go to the land of Israel and you have a place you can study, fine. But in terms of America, Canada, he didn't think that it was necessary to go, and he actually told people not to go. At the time, it seemed like a sound assumption that Lithuania would remain a safe place for Jews, and thus counseling to stay put seemed like a reasonable opinion, a reasonable position. When you look back at it and you see the way the Soviets had moved and what the plan was, it seems very foolish. Obviously, they were intent on moving in. On the other hand, think about Switzerland, completely surrounded. People felt like Switzerland would remain fine and they wouldn't invade. The Nazis did invade. I think Luxembourg was, if I'm not mistaken, was neutral and they invaded. So there was no guarantee that they wouldn't invade. But at the time, people have a sense that for whatever reason, these countries are safe and there are countries up like Sweden, for instance. I mean, you could have said this about all the countries. I mention this only that we're not invaded. I mention this only because sometimes people like to look back and say, well, it showed the blindness of the rabbis. It wasn't blindness. At this time, if you read the contemporary writings, no one thought that you need to get out immediately of Lithuania. Maybe in the future there's going to be hard times, it could be difficult, blockades, all sorts of things, but no one was running for the exits as we will see them do shortly. I mean, everyone could have gotten out of Lithuania. For that matter, everyone could have gotten out of Poland in 1939. When I say gotten out, they couldn't have come to America. They couldn't have come to Canada. They could have gone to Mozambique. They could have gone to countries in Latin America. There's all sorts of places they could have gone to. But is any Jew going to be going to Mozambique? I mean, in 1939, of course not. Once the Nazis invade, if you can get out, you'd go anywhere, as we'll see. But, what are you going to do? We don't have prophecy anymore. Now, what becomes really interesting, though, and this is what in the Haredi histories, they can't write about this, is that even after the Soviet occupation, Rav Chaim Ozer opposed submitting requests for exit visas. Even though people had a chance to leave under the Sugihara visas, is the biggest example we'll speak about, Rav Chaim Ozer told them to stay put. Shev al taseh was what he said. So why? Why would anyone say not to leave Soviet-occupied Lithuania? We know that Jews had been living in the Soviet Union. You can't be Jewish in the Soviet Union. Jews had lived under the Tsar for generations, and yeah, there was some oppression, but you had Torah scholars and Jewish creativity and all that. And in 20 years, the Soviets destroyed Judaism in its entirety. So what's going on here? Because you have to understand the story, as we're going to see it, is the way to get out was through the Soviet Union. And requesting an exit visa from the Soviet Union, in the past, people who had requested that, people who wanted to leave the Soviet paradise, they had been arrested, they had been sent to Siberia, they had been executed. This was the big question. Not do you get a visa from Sugihara, but do you actually have the courage to request from the Soviets to leave, because no one leaves the Soviet Union. That means you're unpatriotic. And that's the reason that Rav Chaim Ozer and so many others counseled against that. They were terrified that any requests would lead to make things a lot worse. And the way things were going with the war, who knew? Right now you're under the Soviets. Next month it could be a changed again, and it could be a new Lithuania, or maybe another route opens up, but not to exit through the Soviet Union. A book came out a few years ago in English. It actually was in Yiddish a number of years ago. I want to show it to you here. I highly recommend it. It's called The Veil of Tears by Rabbi Pinchas Hirschsprung. And it's his memoir of life in the Holocaust. and he also made, and how he gets out. It originally appears in Yiddish in 1944. Fortunately, it was not translated by Art Scroll or one of the other Haredi publishing houses, because they would have deleted a lot of what's in there. Even though Rabbi Hirschsprung, for those who don't know, Rabbi Hirschsprung was wasn't just a gadol, he was a super gadol, a super genius, using the word gadol in terms of Torah knowledge. I was present in 1985, maybe if any BMT people were on, you were present there with me at a Siyum HaShas at BMT in 1985, a Beis Medrash Torah, where a group of students, not first year, these were third, fourth year, they were learning, there was a whole program to finish Shas in a few years, more of a Bekiyas sort of thing. They'd learn a few daf a day. And there was a whole big Siyum HaShas, and Rav Gorin came and spoke. And he said at that time that the only person alive who knew the entire Talmud by heart was Rav Hirschsprung. And I remember thinking afterwards, a number of us, that, well, there's another person also, Rav Vad Yosef. I think he probably knew the Talmud by heart, but if you knew the disputes they had back and forth, there's a reason why he wouldn't mention Rav Avadia. But that shows you, to say that, you know, to know the whole Talmud by heart, Rabbi Hirschsprung, I found, and I made reference to them in one of my blog posts, that when he was only 14 years old, Rabbi Hirschsprung published in a Torah journal, his Talmudic notes. He edited at age of 16. There was a Torah journal that came in Krakow. A real genius of genius, Rabbi Hirschsprung. He has a son-in-law in, I think even two, children in Toronto, and grandchildren. I don't know if any are left in Montreal. In any event, a very interesting person. And let me just give you an example of some of the things that would have been taken out had the Art Scroll translated it. For example, he mentions that during the war, he had thoughts of suicide. Not something that you'd expect. He writes once after a journey he took, "I slept well, woke up past noon, and recited the morning prayers far too late." I don't think a Haredi publishing house would mention that a future Kotel B'Yisrael missed a Zman Tefillah, even if it is during the war. He writes, quote, "I was envious of this woman's profound belief in divine providence." He speaks about meeting a woman who, despite everything that was happening, she still had absolute faith in God's providence. And he lets us know that he didn't. He wasn't so sure. You know, even the great Torah sage like him was having doubts. He mentions how "I stealthily took some water from the town's mikveh." That is, we needed some water and he took some. Okay, but these are just the sort of things that I'm glad that were included here. But he says something else, and I want to read it for you. And this is on page 246 and 247, because he comes from Chachmei Lublin. He comes from a Hasidic background, and they were also in, and they had the question that everyone's going to have: do you leave Vilna? Do you take the visas? And I'll talk in detail what these visas were, because it actually is a transit visa that they need, but before to Japan. But before that, they only get the transit visa if they get a Dutch visa. And the Dutch visa, as we'll see, was actually to enter Curaçao. Curaçao, the island of Curaçao, which only becomes an independent country, I believe, in 2010. But the whole plan was they never were going to Japan. They were going to Curaçao. So the consul, the Dutch consul, is also one of the righteous of Israel. We hear so much about Sugihara. I'm not sure why we don't hear enough about the Dutch consul, whose name, I can't even pronounce it, so I won't. Jan Zwarunt, I forget how you pronounce it. So to the comments, someone made a comment to me. Yes, I will get to that at the end. So this is what Rabbi Hirschsprung writes. They went to Rav Chaim Ozer, and they asked, "Is it worth obtaining the Dutch visa?" Because with the Dutch visa, then you go to Sugihara. The Gaon, that's Rav Chaim Ozer, thought for a while and then said, "It's written, Shev al tase adif. That is better to remain still. Don't do anything. Stay here." He says that in the future, you'll be able to go if you need to leave. But at the moment, you know, in other words, don't leave running away. The time will come, you'll be able in an organized fashion to either make your way to America or make your way to Eretz Yisrael. What are you going to go pass through the Soviet Union? You're going to pass, go to Japan. What's in Japan? It's crazy stuff. Go to Curacao. And then he continues with the whole talk, and he says that this America is the last exile. The Torah will be redeemed with the entire people of Israel. So he's hoping that they'll make it to America. Then he says, we said goodbye to the Gaon and left his house. As soon as we stepped outside, we began to have doubts about the visas. He mentioned he went together with a young chassid who was with him. And the young chassid, with his characteristic disdain for the great Misnagdim council, precisely because the Gaon is against obtaining these visas, we should get them. In other words, so here he mentions that a Hasidic youth said, because Rav Chaim Ozer said not to get them, we better get the visas, because if you're a chassid, whatever the Misnagid says has to be wrong. And then he talks about how all the refugees who were there in Vilna were very skeptical of the Dutch visa, and later it's going to be the same thing with the Sugihara visas. You know what they called it? They called the visa Asher Yatzer paper. That is, the stamp, the visa with the stamp in it, which is toilet paper. It's useless. It wasn't going to get you anything. And then if you go on, you can read how he doesn't listen. They don't listen to Rav Chaim Ozer in the end, and that's what saved his life, and that's what saved their lives. He talks about he went to the synagogues, and the city's Jewish lay leadership was also opposed to accepting transit visas because they thought that they would get in trouble with the Soviets. And then it says, our chassid was arguing passionately that the opposition of the Misnagdim to the transit visas, Vilna, of course, is all Misnagdim, was a sign from heaven that we should snatch them up. We held a meeting at our yeshiva where it was unanimously decided that although the visas were questionable, nevertheless, out of an abundance of caution, it was worth obtaining them. So the yeshiva Schachme Lublin decides that they're going to go get the Kovno visas, and then they have the Dutch visas, and then they get the Sugihara visas. And remember, this is just getting the visas. They're not even leaving yet. Then you have to go to the Soviets and get the exit visa. So Rav Chaim Ozer and the others were afraid of even going ahead to try to take this step, I guess because they figured if you go ahead and get the visas, then you're going to have a Yetzer Hara to want to actually try to get out. And Rav Chaim Ozer and the lay leadership's position was stay put, don't go anywhere. It's this story of the mistakes of the Gadol Yisrael, mistakes only in retrospect. No one can look at them as mistakes of the time. This is very different than what, if we would talk about, for example, the Satmar Rebbe arguing, let's say 43 and even later, don't leave. You don't want to go to Eretz Yisrael, let's stay, we'll be fine here in Hungary. That was a different circumstance. That was opposition motivated by anti-Zionism and other reasons. Here is different. Here it's, nevertheless, it wasn't a clear-cut case, as we see. Zorach Varhaftig, I spoke a good deal about this in the classes on Rav Aaron Cutler, so let me just mention quickly that Zorach Varhaftig, who becomes, when he makes it to Eretz Yisrael, he goes to Eretz Yisrael in 1947, a big religious Zionist, he signs the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and he also is in the Israeli government in numerous positions for 25 years, I think. But he was in Vilna at this time, and he was urging everyone to leave. And Rav Aaron Cutler, he mentions, was the strongest opponent. Rav Aaron Cutler said that these were Asher Yatzer papers. And to the end of his life, he was upset with Rav Aaron Cutler. Zorach Weierhaftig comes from a very important rabbinic family as well. His father was a big Rav. Rav Yerucham Varhaftig. Let me just read you what he wrote, what he gave an interview. He says the sharpest in opposition, because what he was doing is he was working with the religious Zionists while he was in Vilna, and he was trying to organize, everyone to leave, to get them visas, to go. And he's the one who was very active in convincing people to take the Sugihara visas. And he was very frustrated that although he is one of those like Jabotinsky type people who sees that the future is not going to be bright and we have to get out as soon as we can, And if you can't go to Israel, you have to go, or sorry, you have to go somewhere else. He was meeting with people who were seeing sunshine in the future. And he says that the harshest in the opposition was Rav Aaron Cutler. He called the visas near Asher Yatzer paper. And he pressured his students not to take them. And this is, listen what he says. In the end, Rabbi Cutler remains in Lithuania, but when Varhaftig makes his way to Japan, he actually was able to get exit visas the transit visas, were able to give them for Rav Aaron Cutler and his wife, Talmidav, Shishamu Bekolo, Umatzot, no Mitzvah. However, all of Rav Aaron's students that he told them not to take the visas and to remain here, they didn't get out. So that's why Zerach Varhaftig, to the end of his life, did not have good feelings about Rav Aaron Cutler, because he thought that Rav Aaron Cutler was very strong in his opposition. And we have another evidence of this in this book. Rav Aaron Cutler basically was strong in everything he did. And so much he did, achieved great things. But in this matter, where he was terribly wrong, the fact that he was strong also was a problem, because who would go against him? I want to show you, read you something else where we have testimony on this. This book, this is an important book. Hillel Levine from Boston University is in search of Sugihara. This is the standard work now on Sugihara. But I'm going to read you something that he writes. You can find this on page 242, 243, where he's interviewing Rabbi Eliezer Portnoy, who was one of the students who made it through Shanghai. He speaks about what he calls the worst Shabbos of his life. He's getting off the... He was involved in getting... in getting the visas. I mean, he was one of the people who actually was involved in organizing it. Not just he took it. He organized the whole thing. As he was getting off the train that Friday afternoon in Kovno, whom should he bump into on the platform? Rabbi Aaron Cutler, the head of another of the world famous Lithuanian Torah academies. Rabbi Cutler, supporter of Grzinski's position on Shev Al Taseh, on staying put. Rabbi Grzinski shouted, Cutler had not issued his opinion in the usual responsum, in which significant points of Jewish law are clarified, but in the Kol Kori, a public proclamation issued to the broadest audience. And who was he, Portnoy, a brash putrefier of Israel, to go against his word, Ocher Yisrael? Did this Bachar not know what the Talmud said of those who defy the opinion of the scholars? The great Rav Chaim Ozer had ordered the yeshiva students to gather in Vilna. Yet he, Portnoy, and some other hooligan bachers did not trust in the great rabbi and had the vanity to think they had a better plan. Rabbi Cutler was livid. Portnoy was trembling. So Rabbi Eliezer Portnoy, years later, described how he was yelled at by Rav Aaron Cutler because he was helping organize. He was one of the people who actually the papers to when they gave it to them, he was one of the people that took the papers, the passports, as I recall, to the consulate, I'm not mistaken, or maybe to the, I forget now, or to the Dutch consulate. We'd have to look here. I don't want to look right now. But in any event, so you see what was going on. The only one of the great Torah authorities that I know of who discussed this matter of the fact that they were wrong on this. And I'm actually sympathetic to what he says. He discussed Rav Chaim Ozer and the rest of them, was Rav Yecheskel Levenstein, who was the mashkiach of the yeshiva. Rav Yecheskel Levenstein, who later is at Ponevezh, but at this time he was at the Mir Yeshiva, a great Musar personality, had enormous influence. In fact, he was the primary figure in Shanghai, because as we'll see, the Rosh Yeshiva of Lezer Yehuda Finkel does not go to Shanghai. He said as follows, listen to this, these words. In explaining why And trying to give some sense to the fact that they went to Shanghai, they disagreed, they disobeyed Rav Chaim Moser and the other rabbis. They disobeyed Das Torah, and they survived. And the others who listened to Rav Chaim Moser and the other Rosh Yeshiva, they stayed and were killed. How to understand this? Rav Chesed Levenstein says as follows, quote, "If someone acts crooked and is successful, that which is crooked does not become straight. However, if it is God's will, even something crooked can succeed." This comes directly from the word of mouth of Rav Chesed Levenstein by an eyewitness. What this meant was that what they did was not normal. Now, why did they do it? We'll see soon. They did it against Rav Chesed Levenstein. It was actually the students who forced it, a student rebellion. A few students, but the one in particular, let me show you his picture. This one in particular, who later becomes, I'll talk about him a little later, Rav Aryeh Leib Malin. You can see his picture there. He actually forced the matter, him and a couple others. Not the Rav Chesed Levenstein did not want to leave. And Eliezer Yehuda Finkel did not want to leave. So this was a student rebellion. But Rav Levenstein, we'll see, he agreed to that to go. It was crooked. It was crazy. You're going to go to the Soviets? You're going to ask them for permission to leave the country? What kind of a crazy thing is that? It's a much smarter play to remain in Vilna, stay where you are. Maybe things will change. But to go into the mouth of the lion? You'll end up in Siberia, maybe. Of course, in retrospect, ending up in Siberia was the best thing that could happen to you, almost the best thing. The best thing is to go to Japan, but the second best thing is to end up in Siberia, because then at least you would survive. Those who remained in Vilna, of course, were murdered by the Nazis. So that's what Rav Yecheskel Levenstein says. And in retrospect, I mean, it's easy to say that the Mir Yeshiva made the right decision, but we're with hindsight here. So what Rav Chesel was saying was that in the circumstances, at the time, the decision made by Rav Chaim Moser was the only logical decision to make, and it made the most sense. On the other hand, he goes on, if God wills something different, then of course it's going to be different. And for whatever reason, God willed this to be a miracle. Well, the stories we're going to hear are like as close to miraculous as you can get. And so Rav Chesed said, you can't judge something out of the ordinary, like a miraculous event like this, which shouldn't have ever happened by the normal scheme of things, and then say that Rav Chaim Moser was mistaken. Rav Chaim Moser made the same, and it's not Rav Chaim Moser, it's all the leadership in the community, the lay leadership. And it's not just them, it's the people outside. It's the people who were in Paris and who were in New York, the joint. No one thought at this time that it was an emergency, you had to leave. But Varhaftig, who was going around telling everyone they have to leave, he says as follows in his autobiography. He also quotes this. But might we not learn from the outcome of the affair that our action in encouraging the yeshivas to leave Lithuania was actually straight and right in the eyes of God? You know, it's not crooked? Certainly, in the religious context, the facts speak for themselves. Okay, that's what, you have to give all the credit in the world to Varhaftig. He saw clearly what was going on. And all the yeshivas, the yeshiva students and the mir and everyone involved, thank Varhaftig for his great assistance in this. But who could have anticipated this? Of course, in the yeshiva world, someone like Rav Chaim Moser is given enormous authority, not only in halachic matters, but in everything, in Das Torah. So when he gave his opinion not to leave, that had great influence. The real significance, however, is the fact that the Mir Yeshiva, under the leadership of Eliezer Yehuda Finkel, and it's under his leadership, Rav Yecheskel is not the leader of the yeshiva. He basically has to run it to a certain extent in Shanghai, but he's not the leader of it. The Rosh Yeshiva is Rav Eliezer Yehuda Finkel. Rav Chesed Levenstein is an employee of the yeshiva, and he doesn't make the decisions. The decisions are made from Eliezer Yehuda Finkel. And Rav Eliezer Yehuda Finkel agrees to go against Rav Chaim Moser. It's one thing even for yeshiva students. Can you imagine for a Rosh Yeshiva to go against what the Gadol Hador said? He begins arranging the travel documents against what Reclaim Moser says, which will enable the yeshiva students to go to Japan. The evidence is that Rav Lezer Yudofinkel's opinion was also the same as Rav Chaim Moser. Don't leave. Stay in the Soviet Union, stay in Lithuania, even if it's occupied by the Soviet Union. Because if you go, you're going to walk right into the office of the Soviets and ask them for an exit visa. And we know this was the opinion of Rechiska Levenstein. It was only after the student pressure, and I showed you a Varye Leib Malin, that the yeshiva administration agreed to request permission from the Soviet authorities to travel to Japan. Varye Leib Malin is not really well known. You see his dates. He dies young, age 56. Nussan Kamenetsky, incidentally, or Nussan Kamenetsky, he learned with Varye Leib Malin, because Varye Leib Malin in New York opens up a... like a kollel sort of yeshiva, but it's small. He was considered one of the great Torah scholars. Had he not passed away young, he would have had a great influence. And he's, we know that he, in all the reports, he's mentioned as putting pressure on. And the students had a revolt. And the students pressured the Rosh Yeshiva, the Mashkiach, and they agreed because of the student pressure. None of us were there then, so it's hard to know what the environment was, but you have to assume that there was a lot of tension in the air as the students were saying, we have to do this. They had become convinced by people like Rav Aryeh Leib Malin and others who maybe were convinced by Varhaftig that they have to get out. I say none of us were there. I don't know if there is anyone left alive today who was in the mirror in Shanghai. If there is, you can, I mean, you have to be quite elderly, because let's say you're 15 in 1940. Well, I guess, I mean, you could be. Well, you're born in 1925, so you're 95, it's possible. But I don't know of any who are still alive. But so this is an amazing story, an amazing case, interesting, where yeshiva students who were trained to have such respect for Torah scholars, Gedolim, nevertheless choose a different path. And it's precisely because of this that they were able to escape from Soviet-occupied Lithuania. We will come back to Rav Aryeh Leib Malin later. So who could, now all these students at the Mir, almost all of them, were from Poland. Take a look at the map again. I'll pull it up here. The best map I have here. Here. They were all basically from Poland, which meant that they had Polish passports. The ones who were from Russia, if there were any, well, at this time there weren't any, leave Russia out of it. Although if people had escaped from Russia, they were in a difficult situation because they didn't have any passports. But if you were from Lithuania, you have a big problem, because it's been taken over now by the Soviets, and you are considered a Soviet a citizen. So fortunately, almost all the Mir students were from Poland, which meant that they would be allowed to leave because they were not Russian citizens. So when we speak about the yeshiva as a whole, the only yeshiva as a whole that was allowed to that was able to escape and survive the war, it's not 100% true, but it's close enough, because there were only a few students who had been living in independent Lithuania. Let's say you were living in Kovno and you came to the Mir. Most people in Kovno wouldn't go to the Mir. I mean, you have other yeshivas that are closer. You had Sobotka, for instance, you had other yeshivas. But if you were from Lithuania, then you could not leave, and that's the case. Some of them were not allowed to leave with the yeshiva. There were also some who, for one reason or another, did not wish to make the journey. Either they had elderly parents or a variety of reasons, and unfortunately they were murdered. But the overwhelming majority, probably 95%+ of the students left. And of course they left their parents. Their parents were still in Poland. And they all left with the yeshiva, not thinking, of course, their parents would be murdered, but that was the situation. By the time, and I will get into the details next class, I see it's going to be more than two classes. by the time we get into the, by the time all the other yeshivas realized that there was no future in Lithuania, it was then too late for almost all of their students. It's precisely because the Mir thoughts early. The heads of other yeshivos and other important, well-connected rabbis were able to leave. That's a fact. The Brisker Rav, for instance, he received a certificate to enter Palestine from Rabbi Herzog. Other rabbis were together with him. Rav Shach was one of them. A number of others, Chizkiel Mishakovsky. They traveled through the Soviet Union and left by boat from Odessa. But they were given in Palestine, there was a limited number of admissions that you could have. And the chief rabbi was given a certain number of 100 or so that he could give to great Torah scholars. At least he chose to give it. He'd give it to whoever he wanted to. And he gave it to great Torah scholars. So the fact that fact allowed a number of great Torah scholars and leaders, Rav Aaron Cutler, we saw he made it out also. And the students did not have that. This raises the question we've spoken about in previous classes. What's the role of the rabbi? You know, does there come a time where it's every man for themselves? And therefore, even if you're a rav of a community, if you can get out, get out. Or should the rabbi remain, or the Rosh Yeshiva remain to the end with the students? What's the role? Or maybe we know Rav Aaron thought he could help rescue them better from coming to America. This is a question none of us can answer, and none of us should even want be interested in that. It's an impossible question. I know Rav Moshe Feinstein, when he came to America, he thought that he was going to be looked at negatively, because he abandoned his community, he thought they would say. But it's known that when he remained there, in those days, rabbis could leave. Regular people couldn't leave. Rabbis could often get out because they could get visas to America. It was almost impossible to get into America. But when he saw that he couldn't educate his children Jewishly, you know, we say, Aniye Ircha, you know, the poor of your own, yourself, your family goes before everyone else. If there's a choice between the community and you can't teach your own children Torah, obviously you have to leave. I remember I asked Alexander Altman, Rabbi Dr. Alexander Altman. He was one of the leading rabbis in Berlin. And he leaves in October of 1938. And I asked him, you know, Leo Beck remained. He said, as long as there's a minion, I'm going to remain. And I knew Altman because then he later, after the war, he no longer served as a rabbi. He was a professor in England. We went to Manchester. He was a rabbi in Manchester for 20 years. Rav Yitzhak Yaakov Weiss of the Eda Charedit was on his beit din. It's a story for a different time. But when I met him in Brandeis and I asked him, did you ever have any pangs of conscience? You know, in 1938, October, you're leaving your community. And he said, no. He said, because by end of 1938, this is before Kristallnacht, Kavah Homer after Kristallnacht, he said, everyone understood that there was no future and it was every man for himself. And he felt that if he has a chance, he was offered this position in Manchester to get his family out, that now it's, you know, the ship is, it's cracked. And everyone is grabbing for a life jacket. That doesn't mean he's more deserving of others, but he's not less deserving. On the other hand, other rabbis remained. Rabbi Karlbach in Hamburg, others didn't leave. So the fact is that rabbis had connections in the last months when you could get out through America and through Eretz Yisrael with Rabbi Herzog in America with the Agudas Rabbanim. So it was a lot better to be a rabbi than it was to be a simple person, just like it was a lot better to be a wealthy person. It was a lot better to be someone who had family in America. And that's the reality. Why did the Soviet Union? Well, we'll go five more minutes and then I'll take the comments and questions. Why did the Soviet Union do what everyone said they could never do, they would never do, allow yeshiva students, Jewish yeshiva students, the ultimate opponents of the whole communist atheist system, why would they allow them to leave? No one can leave the Soviet Union. It remained until the Iron Curtain fell, a vast prison. And the only ones who ever were let out really were the Jews. That was for political reasons. You know, we all remember the Soviet Jewry situation. Well, political reasons, perhaps, but monetary reasons seem to be the best thing. It seems that was a money calculation. Everyone who left had to pay a significant amount of money. And they were in desperate need of hard currency, American. They wanted American money. Now, where would they get money? How did these people, these yeshiva students, how did they get money? Well, that's going to bring us to another interesting part of the story that we'll pick up next class. Much of this was coming from America. In fact, the money supporting the yeshiva was coming from America, both in Europe and then when they went to Japan, and even after Pearl Harbor, when money could no longer legally be sent from America to Japan for obvious reasons. You don't transfer money to the enemy. Money was still going from America to Japan. It was going through Switzerland. It was going through Uruguay. There was other ways to get it there. There was an important rabbi named Rav Avraham Kalmanovitz who also leaves around this time. He makes his way to America, and he raised an enormous amount of money. We're going to speak about Vlad Hatzala. Rav Kalmanovitz, and the stories are legendary, he even violated Shabbos. There were times when he received a telegram on Shabbos and money needed to be raised. They needed the final cash that needed to be transferred to Intorist in order for them to get the tickets that would take them through the Soviet Union all the way to the end on the eastern side of the Soviet Union. They raised that money. Part of it was raised on Shabbos, where it was a Bikuach Nefesh and Avraham Kalmanovitz. And one of the times he was with Rabbi Gedalia Shor went with him, and they actually went to raise money on Shabbos. So it's an incredible story. We have a lot more to get to. We have to deal with the Sugihara, of course, leaving Japan, the halachic issues that come, leaving Vilna, the halachic issues that come up in Japan, unbelievable halachic issues, and then the experience of Jews in Shanghai. What was it like living in Shanghai? What is Shanghai? How did Jews get to Shanghai? Jews actually preceded the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai. They were there after the Mir Yeshiva left, and we have a lot to do. And I said two classes. I see already now, because I'm treating this not as a lecture. We're treating us as the typical classes. We'll go if it's three classes, if it's four, if it's five. And this isn't with my university students. No one's forced to be here. So we have all sorts of interesting things. The esrog, the Chinese esrog. Would you believe it? There's an esrog in China? Because where else are you supposed to get an esrog for Sukkot? So where's the dateline? Where do you observe Shabbos and Yom Kippur? So all sorts of good stuff we're going to get to. Let me now look at some of these questions or comments. One of you texted me privately that you were at Shanghai and found the ghetto and museum fascinating. Yes, the museum, the museum there, which is a shul, was actually a place where the yeshiva was for a time, or part of the yeshiva. And they have on the outside of the museum, I highly encourage everyone to go. Obviously not now. One day we'll be able to travel again, unless you're holding a grudge against China, who's responsible for all this mess probably. But you can see on the outside of the shul there, there's all the names. They say it's all the names of the people who came out during the war years. They take a lot of pride now in this, that they were involved in the rescue for years. It's like everyone else. They didn't talk about this. It's the same thing with Schindler and with the man in Portugal, etc. But now they have a lot of pride. There's a whole exhibit there about saving of the Jews and Shanghai. Of course, it's a little strange when you think about it, because Shanghai was not China then, it was Japanese. So if anyone should get the credit, it should be the Japanese. But China takes the credit, basically, because it's Shanghai. They don't have all the names. I saw some names of famous names of rabbis and yeshiva students, but they don't have all the names out there. But it's, incidentally, not just in Shanghai, but where I was in Nanjing and also in Shandong, you have centers for Jewish studies, believe it or not, in China. Moshe says that his father came through Shanghai with the Lubavitcher Yeshiva. Yes, the yeshivas, the Lubavitcher Yeshiva we'll talk about, which was then actually recreated in Shanghai. People don't realize that. Chaim mentions there are Rebbes at RJJ were from Shanghai. Yes, from MTA had a number. Rav Henoch Fishman, for instance. Rav Henoch Fishman was at the Mir, and many, many in the New York area. Devorah, the Avodas HaMelech of Rav Menachem Krakowski, quotes a shtickle Torah from Avram Tzvi Kamai in at least one place. I did not know that. The only thing I know about the Avodas HaMelech is that he quotes Rav Soloveitchik, his nephew, who was in Berlin at the time, and checked the Rambam manuscripts. I think he quotes them five times. Moshe says, and I repeat this out loud because the people who listen on tape, they want to hear what I'm responding to. My father said that once they applied for exit visas, following the example of the Amshin Over and Moshe Surabim, they did not sleep in the same place two nights in a row to avoid any possible arrest. Thank you, Moshe, for that, Moshe. It gives a sense of what they were feeling. And we'll speak about the Amshin Over. The Amshin Over, plays an important role in Shanghai and even before going there, because he also felt that it's time to leave. Rabbi Kelman says, yes, the chief rabbi of Montreal, Rabbi Hirschsprung, when I was in high school, when he spoke, and he was in high school, he spoke to the pin test. That is, he could tell you, you put a pin through a Gemara, and he could tell you on the 30th page, you know, well, what it's speaking about with the pin. There's a video online. You can Google it, and you can find they made a video about Rabbi Hirschsprung. And I think it's about 25 minutes about his life with all sorts of good videos. I saw it on YouTube. Rav Hirschsprung is the only Haskaman, Rav Schachter's first Sefer. Someone wrote to me privately that he thinks Rav Shaul Lieberman probably knew all the Talmud and the rest of rabbinic literature by heart. Actually, in this book, there's a book that came out in the 80s, and it was a Jewish Book of Why, I think it's called, and it had a thing there about people who know the Talmud by heart, and it listed two people there, Shaul Lieberman and Rav Avad Yosef. It did not list Rabbi Hirschsprung. Shaul Lieberman, Rav Gorin has a story he tells where he asked Rav Shaul Lieberman a question, and Shaul Lieberman in his mind starts going over each daf of Gemara. It's unbelievable what Shaul Lieberman had in his mind. Devorah points out to the other Haskamas. Zarek Varhaftig's role was that he was also, there was an office there for Palestine Zionists, and he was involved in giving people entry permits to the land of Israel and also helping organize people to go. When he heard that Sugihara was giving visas, he went to everyone and tried to encourage them to leave. And he was able to convince people, but he met a lot of opposition. Rafal says Leibma was more than a student. He was a leader in the yeshiva. He was a student leader, I guess you could say. That's a good way to put it. And he's older. Remember where he's born. He's born in 1906, so he's not a youngster. You had this yeshiva since those days were older than we think of today, but he was a leader. We're going to see another example of this when you observe Shabbos. Two people get involved in this question of when you observe Shabbos, and that's Rav Aryeh Leib Malin and Rav Yechezkel Levenstein. Because you observe Shabbos on Shabbos or Sunday? I mean, Saturday or Sunday. So yes, Rav Aryeh Leib Malin is not, he's not a twerp. He just joined, a 17-year-old twerp who just joined the yeshiva. He was very much, okay, what was the Russian reaction to the request of the exit visa? Someone emailed me privately. That's what we're going to see. Well, we know the reaction is that they let him leave. The question is why? And we'll get into that as well. Devorah, the idea of yeshiva student bowing to Das Torah is a bit anachronistic. The European yeshivas had numerous student revolts in the early 1900s. Yes, in fact, we've spoken about them. The biggest revolt was in Telz, but you had revolts in Slobodka and other places as well. And we spoke about what happened in Volozhin, the way they treated the Netziv and even Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. You didn't really have Das Torah in the early 1900s. They didn't have it. But already by the mid-1900s, you had, even if they didn't use the word, you had the development of the idea. Because once the Aguda gets on the scene, you do have Das Torah really becomes more significant. But you're right, it's not the same as it is today. But even today, plenty of people would not listen to it. It still is significant that on an important matter, if the students don't care for the Rosh Yeshiva, it was important, and we know it's important. I mean, that's Rav Aaron Cutler's whole point was that we don't know what his viewpoint independently was. Maybe Rav Aaron thought you should leave. But once Rav Chaim Ozer said to stay, Rav Aaron thought that everyone should fall in line. Yeah. Charlie says that he has a faculty colleague in my department who got out on a Sugihara visa. She's still alive, remembers Sugihara, and is still working part-time. and she's visited Sugihara's relatives. Yes, I know of people, Sugihara visas, who are alive. I mentioned particularly the Mir Yeshiva. Are any of them still alive? You have children who got out. And of course, they're still alive. Incidentally, you had people who came to Shanghai were not on Sugihara visas. See if anyone could figure it out. An important member of American government. We'll talk about this next class. Well, actually, you know, one of the Secretary of Treasury, Blumenthal, I believe was his name, was in Shanghai. When you go there, you can go, there's a plaque in front of his house. I forget, maybe someone remembers his name in the Carter administration, I think. But there's a number of Sugihara visas. David asks, did the opposition of the rabbis to apply to visas apply to those who are Polish citizens? It seems like a big difference between a Soviet citizen applying and a Polish citizen applying. It was only Polish citizens. A Soviet citizen could apply. A Soviet citizen, of course, couldn't leave. But the people, the only Soviet citizens there were in Lithuania before the Soviets come in June 1940 are the the only ones there are people who escaped from the Soviet Union illegally. And they're criminals. They left the Soviet Union. So Soviet citizens, it never was a thing. There was some talk, maybe get them fake passports, forged passports, the whole forgery industry going on. But the thing is, even when they got Lithuanian passport, the Lithuanian passport became meaningless as soon as the Soviets moved in. In terms of the Polish passport, I have to clarify something here because I'll say this next time, but I'll say it now as well. There actually wasn't the Polish passport anymore, technically, because Poland didn't exist. When Germany comes in from the West and the Soviets from the East, Poland ceases to exist. So there's no country. So no country now recognized the passports. However, you had a Polish government in exile, and they were not in Lithuania, but the British embassy was functioning for them as their embassy in exile, and they issued, it's like a pass. It's like United Nations workers have these passes, not regular passports. And no one actually knew if this pass would be recognized because it's not really a country. It's like a Polish free pass for a country that doesn't exist anymore. So there's all sorts of questions. Someone asked privately who financed the trip of the Mir Yeshiva students. That was money, almost all of it came from America, as I mentioned, Rev Kalmanovitz. Some of these questions were before we got to it. Ariel says, the students left because they believed it was dangerous. Why didn't the yeshiva students leave their parents and not bring them along? The parents were far away, living in towns. The parents were also now under Soviet control. So the parents weren't going anywhere. So the question was, do you remain in Lithuania? Or do you, which is free, and then later it's communist. Some people chose to leave Lithuania when it became communist, taken over by the Soviets, and move back to their parents in Soviet-occupied Poland. And those are the people who didn't survive. Okay, why wasn't Reb Lazer Yehuda Finkel with the yeshiva? We'll get to that. Moshe says his father was ransomed on Shabbos. I believe it's on Eishishak. Citrus comes from East Asia. Yes, it does, Ellen. We'll get to that. I'll show you a picture of the Chinese etrog. Why do the Chinese act benevolently toward the Jews privately? We will get to that. It's not what you'd expect the allies of the Nazis to be helping out the Jews. Israel says he was in the Sugihara Museum in Kovno, where they have many interesting exhibits. They have a list of every visa issued by Sugihara. And in the Levine book, you can see, whenever he discusses someone, he says, Varhoff, the Sugihara visa number 524. We have the entire list. Levine's book is really incredible. He doesn't know Japanese. I'm certain of that. He's in BU. But he had all these research assistants. The book was published in 96, and he uses the Japanese archives, and we have all sorts of stuff about Sugihara. Naomi says that she was born in Shanghai. Dad was from Tells. Ah, so nice to hear that. It was actually a Tells student who's responsible for the whole Sugihara visas, because he came from the Netherlands, and he had a connection with the Dutch consul. And it was him who comes up with the idea of going to Curacao. And then he shares it with his friends in the other yeshivas, including the Mir. So we really, for the saving of the Amir Yeshiva, you have to thank Atel's Bacher, who was from the Netherlands, who was friendly. That you had the Dutch consul in Kovno. When I say a consul, it's not a paid job. This was a guy who worked for Philips Corporation, but he was in Lithuania and he lived in the Netherlands, lived in Kovno. So the Netherlands government asked him if he would serve as the consul and issue visas. So it's like a part-time thing. So he did that. So Tells plays a very important role here. Someone asked me, hiking at a recording for his father who was born in Shanghai, who couldn't log in. This will all be by tomorrow or the next day. It'll all be on the Torah in Motion website. And but have your father, if he can, join us. I'm sure he doesn't remember that much. Or maybe, I don't know, I shouldn't say it. I don't know how old he is. He can add to, when we talk about the experience of Shanghai. The talk actually that I gave in China was not about any of this. It was, I just added this to speak to us. The talk is about the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai. They wanted me to speak about what it was for Yeshiva students from Eastern Europe to be in such a different culture, and did it influence them, and how they lived in Shanghai. Israel says that Rav Chaim Kreisworth knew Bavli and Yerushalmi by heart. Could be. He also was one of these. And he also got out. I think he got out together with the Brisker Rav, if I'm not mistaken, with one of those visas through Odessa. Nazi Germany was an ally of Japan, so why would the Japanese act kindly towards the Jews? Stay tuned. But think about the Russo-Japanese War and who helped Japan with great bank loan in that war. So we'll get to that. Someone asked privately, why did Rav Aaron leave if Rav Chaim Moser said not to go? Because when Rav Aaron left, then it was obvious there was no future. It was finished. After a couple months under the Soviets, it was obvious that there was no future there. Israel says all those student revolts were pre-World War I. Perhaps afterwards they adopted the doctrine of Das Torah. Rav Moshe Feinstein used to joke that, he was born before Das Torah. Benny Fishoff was a student of Chachmei Lublin who escaped to Shanghai, is still alive. Okay, I didn't know he was still alive. But in all the discussions of the Shanghai experience, they always quote Fishoff. So I'm happy to hear that. But is there anyone from the Mir still alive? I don't know. Okay, Moshe says the Nazis tried to convince the Japanese. We will get to that. The Japanese almost did. That I think is actually above myself. But I'll explain why I think that is. And there is a famous meeting. The Amshinover, the famous meeting where the Amshinover Rebbe says that the Germans hate us because we're Asians like you. But the story of the Nazis, of the Japanese, we know the Germans wanted the Jews to be killed, of course. And the ghettos were due to German influence. Whether there was ever a plan from the Japanese to kill the Jews, which is reported there was, and it's reported in, I'll tell you the source it is, I do not believe it to be true, and I'll explain to you why I don't, because of the contemporaneous, but that's taking us to the end. David says, there's an amazing Jewish student center in Kovno, led from Moshe Sheinfeld, serving close to 400 Israeli students studying in Kovno, and you were present at the Hachnasa Sefer Torah in Kovno last year, the first one since the Shoah. It's an amazing thing that everywhere you go in Europe now, you have Israeli medical students in Debrecen in Hungary. You have a Chabad house in Debrecen in Hungary. Why would you have a Chabad house in Debrecen in Hungary? You don't really have a community there, but you have all the Israelis. They come to the university, a medical school. You have all over Europe now, you have Israelis at medical schools. So Chabad goes there. Yes. Grandpa, someone asked me, writes to me privately, was I referring to the Dutch citizen Nathan Nusson Gutworth, our stepfather who arranged the visas to Curacao? I don't know who Grandpa Ma is, but I see that. And yes, I was referring to your stepfather, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And before he passed, he gave an interview and he gave his whole story, but he is the reason. We have to give all the credit in the world to the consul and give all the credit in the world to Sugihara, but just as much credit to Nathan Nusson Gutworth from Tells, from Holland, who came up with the idea that he's a Dutch citizen and he can go to Curacao because that's a Dutch place. And not only that, everyone else can go to Curacao because, as we'll see, you really didn't need a visa to go to Curacao. So we'll speak about that next class. Rafael, I will speak about the Mir Yeshiva and the Lubavitch group. This is a very touchy issue. It's not the Mir Yeshiva per se. It's the Agudas, it's the Vat Hatzalah in New York and the Lubavitch group, Lubavitch Yeshiva. It led to a Din Torah after the war. And yes, this is not, we don't cover anything up. I will talk about the Machlokas. It was not a Machlokas between the Mir and the Lubavitch. I can tell you that. The bad feelings are not in Shanghai. It's really in New York. That's the issue. And I will get to that. And finally, from Danny, there was a Jewish group outside the Mir Yeshiva that's made its way to Shanghai by Sugar. Of course, yes, yes. You had students from Kletsk who were there. You had students from Kamenetsk. You had students from Pinsk. And a number of these students ended up joining either Chachmei Lublin or joining the Mir. People made their way independently. The Mir, however, is unique in that it came as a group, the same unit. They went together as a group with the visas on the train, all together. And that's why it's important. That's why we're talking about the Mir. But yes, and there are people, irreligious people who are in Shanghai, all sorts of people in Shanghai. We'll speak about what Shanghai was. So with that, I thank you all for joining. We will meet again next week at the same time. And thank you again for all the comments and questions. And wow, I'm excited that the stepchild or children of Nathan Gutworth, the person who doesn't get, most people don't know about him, but he more than anyone else is responsible for everything we're going to see because it was his idea. And so it's, I guess it's a real zechus and a big thrill that you're listening to this. And I have to say, I was just going to mention him a little bit. Maybe I should go into a little more detail next class because of that. But thank you all very much. And Rabbi, thank you want to say something before we leave?
Thank you, everybody. We look forward to seeing you next week and throughout the week from any of our shiurim. Everybody keep well, keep healthy. And thank you very much, Lila, talk to everybody. And thank you again, Dr. Mark, for the fascinating talk. Okay. Laila Tov, everybody.